Dad?
What, Hartley?
Well, you know how you give each hen house 10 acres of pasture space so the hens can do all their natural things?
Yeah, like enjoy sunshine, eat bugs and grass, and get exercise?
Well, if you give all the pasture space to the hens, there won't be any room for Rusty and me to play.
Hartley, the Wilcox farm is over 1,800 acres. We'll always have pasture for kids and hens to enjoy.
Cool. Catch you later. Rusty's waiting. Wilcox Family Farms. Locally fresh since 1909.
Hey, welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show from the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, or at least that's where I am. I'm Chef Tom Douglas, owner of several of Seattle's fine restaurants, vacationing here, taking a bucket list item off of my wife's list. This has been a place. I'm at Blackberry Farm, a place that she has always wanted to go, being the farmer that she is, and also with the cute little farm dinners that we do at our farm, Prosser Farm. This is Jackie's... I think there's about 20 things on our bucket list, and so now we're down to 19. And at our age, we better get busy. Anyway, welcome back from Vietnam, Terry and Katie.
Oh, absolutely. Hello, Tom. It's nice to hear you're in Tennessee, but, you know, it's beautiful weather in Seattle. I think it's at least 80 degrees here.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're looking at, but I don't know where you left town.
I think Terry's delusional from his trip, but we are reporting from the Cairo Studios, which is new and fun for us, or a little bit old and reminiscent, I suppose, to the good old days, as opposed to the Hot Stove
right.
Society. So we are happy to be connecting with you, Mr. Douglas.
Absolutely. You know, it's it used to be that when I did this show from the road, Terry, you remember this.
Yeah.
I used to have to bring a tie line and I would set up on the beach in Hawaii, or we did it from Siena, Italy, or wherever we went. Now with the internet and with this particular app that I have, I can talk to you guys no problem from anywhere in the world.
Oh, so fun.
Over the wires.
Very cool.
Yeah. It's very exciting.
It's progress.
We have a big show today. We're going to talk. Yes, progress, exactly. We're going to talk Starbucks and their new cafe, Robo Chefs. More on food in the news. Our pro tips on how to make pasta delicious, even the simplest pasta. There's some techniques you can use that really will make for a better plate of pasta at the end of the day. Mm. Answers to your food questions and our food for thought tasty trivia challenge, which will be the first time. To do this challenge from the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, which gives me a bit of exuberance to the fact that I'm going to not only win, but I'm going to take you down over the satellite.
It's interesting what kind of confidence is built in you when you're not in the room staring directly into our eyes. Interesting. Very interesting,
well,
Tom.
I'm not sure where my hubris comes from, but it is certainly there, and... I don't know. I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
Just a few things about where I'm staying. This Blackberry Farm,
yeah,
super
let's hear about it.
Expensive. Like I said, it's been on Jackie's bucket list for a long time. Super expensive. Super private, I will say. You know, we're out in the middle of the Smoky Mountains. It's very organic. This place has been rated as one of the top restaurants in America for years and years and years. And if I'm not mistaken, this is where the folks over at the Herb Farm over in Woodinville got their idea for how to open and run their own restaurant. I could be wrong on that, but I think this was a big part of their interest in opening that very fancy, very shishi restaurant over there in Woodinville across from St. Michelle.
It's definitely very similar in terms of what they're trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks a little plus-plus. I'm on the website right now, and those listening can go to blackberryfarm.com and take a look. But it looks like they have all sorts of, like, interior design, home ownership. Like, it's a big property.
Yeah, I want to say it's almost 5,000 acres.
Ooh.
Each of the little places comes with a golf cart, but it's freezing cold. So I've been out rolling around in the golf cart. A couple of things I've noticed already. They really need better coffee here. My goodness. The coffee is a travesty.
Isn't that a funny thing when we travel? And we're going to talk about some travel coming up here in the show, but how much we can appreciate our coffee when we're in Seattle, because, man, you travel anywhere else. It can be challenging to get that good cup.
I must say that when I was in Vietnam, there was one thing that was delicious.
Yes,
the coffee.
They did have good coffee over in Vietnam.
Yeah,
actually,
exactly.
That was delicious coffee.
The other thing I'll say, and it really kind of set me off last night, was to sat down to dinner, and Again, the food was just fine and blah, 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 but it said Wild King Salmon on the menu. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. I wonder what the reality of that is. And so I sent the waiter back and I just said, if you wouldn't mind just asking the provenance on this salmon, I'd be curious where it's coming from, you know, and how it was caught, how it was fled, you know. Yes, go ahead.
Australia. Farm raised.
Yeah, exactly. Ona, I think what do they call that brand? Ona or something like that? Farm raised, and it was, I just read them the riot act. It was so maddening. After all the work we've been doing to try and save Bristol Bay from Pebble Mine and all that sort of thing, you know, chefs are thought leaders these days when it comes to the provenance of our food. And we have to be responsible, and I know we try our best to say exactly what's on the menu, where it's from, and be truthful about it. And I just found it alarming that a place such as this would make that kind of mistake, whether intentionally or mistakenly.
I think it's the same thing with a few items on the food menus nowadays, is you see wild when they actually mean, you know, it's a king salmon, and it's farm-raised in Australia. I've actually had somebody making me try some not too long ago.
Yeah.
And the product is okay, it's delicious, but it's just not, you know, it's not a wild king salmon like we know wild king salmon.
For sure.
Well, yeah, it's not wild at all, it's farmed.
Right.
So anyway, this brings me to road tripping, because we have an event coming up here at the Hot Stove Society, April 27th, 28th, 29th. It's one of our food lovers weekends.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about road food. When you're out driving around across the country, talking about those things that you remember from a little greasy spoon, say on the I-90 somewhere in North Dakota or South Dakota, whatever, you know, or even things that you find on the back roads of Washington State, you know. So we're going to do some road tripping recipes and have a fun ramble across the country as we explore the tastiest regional American foods from diners, food trucks, roadhouses, seafood shacks, and family tables. Mm. That's all the 27th, 28th, and 29th at the Hot Stove Society. And the tickets are available for the weekend. And I've done these. This is about our fifth Food Lovers Weekend. They are intense, but they're super fun.
This one seems like a great one. You know, just having both Terry and I traveling, you know, abroad, it's good to remember that there's so much great food in our own United States backyard. And to have it all kind of centered in Seattle is even more convenient. So very fun.
What would be in one, we only have 1 minute left. What would be one item you would pick if you were thinking road trip around America? What would you pick?
Oh, I think for me, I'd start with breakfast, and I'd say the perfect chicken fried steak or chicken fried chicken, because Terry always thought it was fried chicken.
I'm sorry, but why would you want?
But that would be, and then a great gravy to go with it.
Yeah.
You know, that would be the first thing. Although this morning I had a delicious country Tennessee ham with some really buttery grits for breakfast.
Yeah, so I would make that.
That might be fun too.
I would make that with two eggs Benedict right on top.
Wow, eggs Benedict on top. That's a perfect breakfast.
That's wacky, man. Thinking of cooking up some spaghetti, we've got pro tips on how to make it your best spaghetti ever on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM.
Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen. I am Katie O here with chefs Terry Rotaro and Tom Douglas coming in from Tennessee, coming in hot. And it is time for
coming in hot
from the Smoky Mountains. And it is time, gentlemen, to talk about pasta pro tips. I'm sure you both have a lot of feelings on pasta. Is that correct?
Yes, it's a great vessel to put a lot of beautiful things on it.
Yes, it is. And a simple meal. But even the most simple meals can be made better with a few professional tips. So we're going to go through some and I'm going to get your opinions. First is mastering the bloom. Do you guys know about the bloom?
Tell us about the bloom.
Exactly.
Let me inform you. Let me give you a professional tip on the bloom. The bloom is if you're making a sauce that involves ingredients like, let's say, a base of garlic, your red pepper flake, other chilies, that sort of thing, don't simply toss them into your sauce, but instead start by quickly sauteing them in a small amount of olive oil until fragrant. Do you master the bloom? Is this something you both do?
You know, I don't really make pasta that simply. Of course,
but even just a base to start with your pasta, if it has garlic in it.
One of my favorite pasta as a kid was the one my mom used to make, where she kept a little bit of the liquid that she had cooked the pasta in, and had a ton of butter, and then toss the pasta right in there. And
oh,
that was
we'll
salt
there.
And pepper, and that's it.
Oh, we'll get there, Thierry Rocheteau.
So, yes, I know all about the blooming of the pasta. It's delicious, and I think it's a good... It's when the pasta actually is the king of the plate.
Mm. I think this one is, in terms of the bloom, is a little bit more about taking your oil for your sauce. Like, let's say, even if you're making just a plain old tomato sauce base, and you're going to add your garlic to that, you're going to put your oil in, and then your garlic to kind of release some of those oils. I think that's what they're talking about, the bloom. Tom, is that something that you do when you make a pasta sauce?
Absolutely. And I think, Katie, the most important part of that process is so many times people will turn on the pan, get the olive oil, and next thing you know, it's close to smoking. And they think, oh, my God, it's the oil's ready. And then they throw in their garlic and they throw in their chilies, blah, blah, blah. And now they're burnt.
Right.
Because it literally takes less than 10 seconds with too hot of oil to burn your garlic and your chilies. And you don't think you can burn chilies, but you absolutely can. So the point is, start with a medium to medium low oil and do a soft bloom on your garlic, a soft bloom on your chili peppers. And then when you want to turn it up, you can, like when you're adding your tomato sauce or your herbs or in that nature. But the bloom is really exactly how you described it. It's just getting that fragrant garlic to release its essential oils and to give you the nose, the aroma of the garlic, as well as the mouth.
Right. Good point. And you're right, Tom. It does cook very fast. Even if you're on a medium level heat, garlic is a tender little vegetable. So the next tip we've got is pull the pasta before it's al dente. So this is essentially the idea that, pasta can kind of continues to cook. You know, I grew up in a household, weirdly, and I think this is more of a Japanese thing I was realizing the other day with udon noodles, is that sometimes there are certain types of pastas that you will cook all the way until it's fully cooked and then rinse it. And I think that was a holdover from a Japanese tradition that eked its way into my parents' kitchen. But in fact, with Italian pastas, you're not going to do that. And what you want to do is actually pull the pasta before it's that perfect bite so it doesn't overcook. What are your thoughts on this, professionals?
Okay, so I don't know. I have a thought.
Yes.
I like to pull them when they're al dente, not way before, because the problem is the inside of the pasta does not really finish to cook as much as we think it does. It's not like a piece of meat that carries on as much. I don't know, Tom, do you agree with this?
No, not necessarily, because I don't really think about the pasta cooking so much as I think of it kind of rehydrating, right? You're working, especially with dried pasta, you're working with something that's been dried, and essentially all you're trying to do is rehydrate it. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that it will continue to soften as it sits there, even if it's before it's cooked or before the mouthfeel is perfect. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I think is that unless you're putting a sauce over top of the pasta, it's nice to leave some of the pasta essence, like the hardness, the absorption quality for the sauces that you're making with it. Like, I like it to absorb. If I'm going to cook it, put it into a tomato sauce or a cream sauce, I like to absorb some of that moisture into my pasta. And so that's the only reason I would disagree with you. I do not like beans, I do not like overly al dente pasta where that it sticks to your teeth because there's so much chew left in it.
Right.
And I think that's, like, Jackie, my wife, loves it like that, and I just don't, so.
Oh, Tom, you jumped ahead to pro tips number right after this, the next two, which is to simmer your sauce and noodles in a pan. So I think that's the biggest argument for pulling your pasta before it's perfectly al dente. I didn't learn, again, this technique until later on in life, but even with the most, again, simple tomato sauce and spaghetti noodle, if you finish the cooking within the sauce, that noodle into the sauce, it takes on a lot more flavor than just the sauce, say, sitting right on top of the noodle.
That's how the pasta actually ends up tasting like the sauce, as opposed to just pasta and sauce.
Yeah, it's that absorption that Tom, you were just talking about. And then the next tip is don't toss the pasta water. So a lot of people will take, your boiled noodles, get that colander in the sink, and then just dump everything into the colander, right? And so all the pasta water drains out. But they talk about saving some of that pasta water. Will one of you go over as to why that would be?
I guess I'll start, and then it's You know, we always save a cup. Like when you pour it through the strainer, we put a measuring cup underneath, and I save a cup just to save of the hot pasta water. But here's the problem, or here's the thing on that. If you're using the proper amount of water to begin with, that pasta should be able to boil and flow freely. Your water's not going to be super starchy.
Right.
You're almost better off not worrying about it, and then just use more tomato broth or, you know,
chicken
tomato,
stock.
Whatever it is that you're... chicken stock or something, whatever that is. But if you're cooking pasta in a smaller pan where you don't have quite as much water and it gets a little bit of that milky look, that's the starch. And then, yeah, then it might have some use when you're finishing your pasta.
Mm. Lovely. Okay, so now we're going to go on to tools, saying tools are your best friend. And this one was kind of interesting to me, and I wanted to get your feelings on it, whether or not that you agree, which is chopsticks. Chopsticks, they say, are a pasta maker's best friend. When's the last time you pulled out some chopsticks to cook your pasta?
Not very often.
I use tongs.
Yeah, me too. I use tongs.
That is another, that is generally where I go too. I have a kitchen full of chopsticks, and it makes a lot of sense.
It's a Westerner's chopstick.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, a big part of this is that what we're reading here is espousing that you want to be mixing that pasta quite a bit. And mm-hmm. So without damaging the noodles, the chopsticks are fairly gentle. But I would say that tongs aren't that harsh, as long as you're not,
if you know
really
how to
clamping
use the tong,
down.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And the other thing I thought was interesting about this article was two things. One is that adding fresh nut paste to your pasta when you're making it is kind of interesting to me. I'm definitely going to try that. And also something I don't do often enough, which is toast your black pepper. If you're doing a simple thing like salt and pepper pasta, it's really important to have the black pepper be as delicious as possible.
That is such a smart thing. I've never really thought about doing that either myself, but it makes complete sense given that we toast all of our other spices.
Yeah, just don't keep your nose over the pan. I've done that before. You'd be sneezing for a while.
Dangerous. Dangerous stuff right there. All right. Up next, we are talking food in the news. RoboChefs, Starbucks cocktails. We must be on our way to the internets. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
You're listening to Seattle Kitchen's On Demand, brought to you this week by Bonide. Check out the Bonide family of products for all your gardening needs. Whether it's bugs or weeds, there's a Bonide product to help. Find out more about Bonide and a dealer near you at Bonide.com.
Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen. It is KDO here with Chefs Thierry Rotereau and Tom Douglas. Tom Douglas coming to us live from Tennessee. And Thierry here in the Cairo studios with me, just chomping down some
coffee cake.
Yeah. Very nice.
It's early, coffee cake and coffee,
yeah.
It's delicious.
Yeah, you have to fortify yourself because we are heading into food in the news. And as always, there are a ton of stories to tackle. So like I said, we are coming from the Cairo Radio Studios. Super excited to be here in our little home studio like back in the day. But let's jump into the first story, gentlemen. Flippy, mm-hmm. The fast food robot, sort of, mans the grill at Cali Burger. Now, I must ask first and foremost, we have a Cali Burger here in Seattle. Have either of you
been? We do?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Obviously, I haven't been because I didn't even know it was here.
I don't believe we have the
robot.
Where
are they?
It's on the Ave.
Yeah, it's on the Ave. Oh. And it's modeled after, I think, pretty well-known, the fast food chain In-N-Out, which is really only located
California.
In southern states. So that's kind of their specialty, which is this California-style burger. But the question is they've employed a robot that pretty much only flips the patty. How are we feeling about this?
I don't know. I mean, it's like, why do we need that for?
Why do we need that for?
Do they go through that much volume then they need somebody to be like, tick, 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 tick?
And this is where I think your professional opinions and restaurateur-like natures come into play. Why do you think robot?
Let's finish
in place
to explain the rest of the story. You actually have a human being next to that robot that actually puts the patty on the grill. Mm-hmm. The robot is just flipping the patties.
Mm-hmm. It's got little 3D sensors.
I don't know. It's like, mm-hmm. I don't really, you know.
So, Chef, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Have you ever heard of Cali Burger before?
Tom, I just told you. No, but I know where In-N-Out.
Exactly.
But I've been
exactly
to In-N-Out.
Exactly my point, Chef. No, let me finish. That's exactly my point. Yeah. Katie asked the question, why do you suppose they're doing this? Guess where they're putting their flippy, their little robot thing?
Yeah, in the
right
kitchen.
Right out in the middle, right in the front of the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
It's a
gimmick.
People talking about it. It's no big, yeah, it's a gimmick.
Yeah.
And it's fine. It is what it is. I could care less. One of the interesting things I think is food safety that might come out of it. For example, if the robot's spatula that he uses has a thermometer in it, mm-hmm. It could tell, you know, there's a big deal about getting fast food burgers over 155 degrees by law. It could tell, like, right in the spatula if it's 155 degrees, unlike, say, a chef who might have to put a stick thermometer in there or something like that. So, I don't know. It's a gimmick. It's getting them a lot of attention, and I think that it's perfectly fine.
You think it's perfectly fine. I think it's perfectly fine, too. I don't think it's going to change the industry.
No. I don't think anything like this would ever change.
Yeah, I think, you know,
yes, it will.
I think there's questions, though, along the lines of a lot of the other things we're seeing, like 3D printing of food, you know, with all the touches of technology into kind of our common day food culture. And it'll be interesting to see which things kind of last or morph and stay and which of those things go away. Flippy is just the first, I think, of many things to come in our food
absolutely.
Technology.
Look at the auto industry. It's dominated by robots now. Amazon's warehousing robot building is making all the news. And you know what's going to go first is the cashiers. The whole thing where you just touch screen printing of I wanted a Big Mac with the large fry and a medium Diet Coke and blah, blah, blah,
Tom,
blah, blah.
Tom, I think you are...
That's happening already.
I think you are right on the money. When I was in Tokyo... There were so many restaurants, you know, and places that you definitely want to go. You want to go eat ramen at all these different shops and various things. And they have totally done away with the cashier portion of that mm-hmm. by simply having a vending machine that spits out tickets. You hand over the ticket. They hand you your food. I mean, it's not obviously completely automated. You have people still making your food right in front of you. But it definitely cut out a very serious portion of labor in those places, which I thought was pretty fascinating. All right. Our next article is Starbucks wants people to linger over a cocktail at Reserve stores. So as many of you have heard, Starbucks is opening the first of 1,000 high-end Reserve stores. And one of the things that they want to introduce to folks is the idea of Italian aperitivo culture. Tom, do you want to tell us what Italian aperitivo culture is? I know you've had a few in your day.
You betcha. Well, you know, it's not unlike the Cali Burger Flippy. You know, it's a marketing thing. They've looked for business in the evening hours for a very long time.
Yep.
And I think they see, you know, we worked with them on the roastery store here in Seattle. They see an opportunity to finally get a three-meal service thing going in their stores, which is, you know, when a store sits there empty but open all night long, you're looking for any way to bring customers in. It's a natural evolution. I think they'll do fine at it as long as they keep it focused like they do their stores. You know, those things are machines, those Starbucks stores. People love them, and I think they'll be fine.
Yeah, it's been wild, you know, to see. I live over in the Central District area neighborhood in Seattle, and I'm often walking downtown, and I still pass by the roastery, and boy, oh boy, that place is popping. I went in to go look at Princey. The bakery that actually replaced Sirius Pie Tom. And it was, you know, it's an impressive organization. Starbucks is really good about finding little things to keep business going at all hours. And boy, oh boy, is that place busy. So interested to see how that
I think
develops.
They're going to do very fine with that. I mean, I think it's a good
idea. Yeah, just to be clear, it's not the they're not talking about the roasteries. They're talking about the Reserve stores.
Right. Oh, that's right. The one in South.
Yeah, there's only going to be, you know, I don't know how many roasteries around the world, but that's in the less than 25 category. This is a new initiative for them, and it's going to be thousands of stores eventually all over the world. But it's like a hybrid regular Starbucks, except it'll have the fancy coffee production and these little
bites, olives, and aperitivo sounds like a good idea.
This comes from NPR, and a pretty interesting story, wherein essentially there are a lot of dairy farms that are moving towards becoming plant-based milks. So did you guys dig into this article, Tom, Mr. Douglas?
Well, yeah, they're talking about all sorts of things, like, you know, from almond milk to peanut milk, and I think it's super interesting. And I guess I'm so close to the dairy issue because of having them surround our farm over in eastern Washington. And frankly, it feels odd where the dairy business is right now in this country. It feels like a manufacturing plant, and it feels just... It doesn't feel really super good to me. So I'm curious about it, and I'm curious where that's going to lead long term. And it seems to me, with all the problems people have with dairy, that this is a smart decision for these folks.
Yeah, I wonder about that myself. I think I feel similarly to you, although I've never been a big dairy consumer, just kind of generally. It wasn't something for me, and certainly I'm someone that likes these alternative milks. But it also always begs this other question, that if you start moving away from these cow's milks, which is fine in my opinion, what kind of environment you create when you have a monoculture, when you're really just propagating a lot of soy or a lot of almonds or just one vegetable?
Well, it's not any different than
vegetable.
It's not much different than the milk that exists actually today, like Tom was referring to. You know, we have come down to a system of probably 100 square mile of cow dairy farm that all put their milk into one place. You know, I mean, it's not much different. It's going to come down to the same thing. It's monocropping kind of idea.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I grew up on a farm with 9 cows, and my grandpa would go and milk the cows every morning, and then you had the cow in a big, you know, in a big bundle, whatever, and that's what you had for breakfast.
That's where I like to end, is on a bucolic view of Jerry's lifestyle. So let's end it right there. Up next, we're cooking greens while wearing green for St. Patty's Day. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. To the Seattle Kitchen. It is time for some St. Patty's Day chit chat. Eating some shamrocks.
Not really.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Yeah, we're not actually going to eat some shamrocks, but we definitely are going to talk some greens. I'm Katie O, here with Mr. Thierry Rotereau and Tom Douglas on the phone from Nashville, Tennessee. Hello.
Hello.
Let's get right into it.
I must correct you. I'm not in Nashville.
I
drove 3.5 hours east of Nashville to the Smoky Mountains, and I'm at the famed Blackberry Farm. It's not really a resort, although they do have tennis courts and archery fields. And
it seems very
fancy
resort-y.
Dining. And, yeah, it's a little bit of, maybe it is a little bit of a resort, but it's 4,000 acres of your closest friends.
Looks like there's some sheep. I've been diddling around here on the internet, on the website. Looks like a lot of cheese. That's what I'm really taking in from this trip.
You know,
trip
they
that
make their
on.
Own cheese here, and the ones that I've had so far are quite delicious.
Well, I love to hear that. Let's balance your cheese diet out with some
greens
for St. Patty's Day, and maybe some things that are maybe not everyday common. Let's jump into kohlrabi.
I'm actually on a bandwagon with a kohlrabi lady.
Yes. Will you explain?
I rediscover kohlrabi,
yeah,
actually.
Please explain to the folks what kohlrabi is, because I know that it's very common in people's kitchens.
I would say that kohlrabi is a mild turnip, because it's actually not strong in flavor. It's also a round root vegetable, just like turnip is. And the greens are actually delicious if you take care of them properly, which is, you know, they are very, they have a tendency that if you overcook them, will become very bitter.
Mm-hmm.
But you can stay away from that if you just cook them gently.
So how do you? What's your favorite treatment of kohlrabi greens?
I did grated in sweet and sour kind of idea, like vinegar, sugar, and spices. So I basically pickle them. And also, and it's great in a salad. You add that into a regular salad, and it makes a very nice profile. And also, I like to caramelize them to use them. I did that with the venison medallion the other day. That was quite scrumptious. They hold really well. You know, when you cook them, they hold really well in the pan. Saute them is really delicious. But it's kind of like turnips. You know, it's got a good, it holds together and has good finish flavor once it's done.
Tom, the next one I'm going to give to you, a green that I know is near and dear to your heart, which is spinach.
Oh, I
mean, it's a little bit ubiquitous, but I feel like you are the biggest advocate for certainly sautéed spinach in the morning.
I do. I love spinach. I love it every way. I love spinach and potato soup, you know, just pureed right in the KitchenAid or the Robocoup.
Mm-hmm.
I love quick sautéed. I think so often in restaurants you get it. It is, you know, typically you get the Italian style, maybe with a little bit of raisin or a pine nut, but almost always way too much garlic.
Mm-hmm.
So just be light on the garlic. Let it bloom like we talked about in the pasta segment. Let your garlic bloom a little bit and cook a little bit before you put the wad of spinach on top. Because sometimes you don't cook it enough, right? And the garlic gets enveloped into the leaves of spinach. And next thing you know, when you're eating it, you get a big mouthful of raw garlic. So get it in the pan first. Let it bloom. Then turn up the heat and add your chili flakes and add your spinach and just cook it so gently and get it off while the spinach is not even wilted yet, because the residual heat will continue to cook those tender leaves and it'll be delicious, and it goes with anything.
Yum. I thought about you last night, Tom, because as I was making my broccoli soup, my little pureed broccoli soup, the recipe called for some spinach to be thrown in there at the last minute just to keep it nice and verdant green, and I had the opportunity to use my beautiful KitchenAid hand blender. So thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Those
that.
Are great
and
tools.
Did it puree up beautifully?
It was beautiful. It was extra, extra silky smooth. And again, that little bit of spinach really kind of brightened up the whole soup and kept it nice and green, which was nice. Because sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, you have a green pureed soup like that and it can get a little gray.
Especially
and
broccoli,
gray and sad.
They will yellow up a little bit.
Right. So the spinach kept it nice. All right. Thierry Rotero,
yep.
Talk to me about chard.
Chard, the great thing about chard, again, one of those greens that you can use both the green part and the stem part,
mm-hmm.
which I love when vegetables do that because there's no waste. And also it brings a nice little, you know, when you're cooking, it's nice because it makes a nice little contrast on the plate. The stem, I love to do the Swiss chard, the white one,
mm-hmm.
when they're very nicely white and aged, to do them in a little cream, just very simple little cream and chicken stock. Very simply done, very cooked, very gently. And they become tender as soon as they're, you know, croquant, tender. You pull them out and you have one.
Excuse me, croquant? What's
croquant
the,
and what, tender. Croquant is crunchy.
Okay.
And tender is, so it's kind of a, you know, plus and minus kind of idea.
I like this. We got a little bit of a French lesson in there.
Yeah,
too.
Croquant. Anyway, so when you get that tenderness on that Swiss chard, and Swiss chard is great. It goes well with like a black cod, steamed black cod or... I mean, fish and Swiss chard is delicious. And also, you could make, you know, I know Tom's going to laugh, but a gratin of Swiss chard is one of the most beautiful things in the world. And you can make that the day before your dinner or your lunch and rewarm it up on the spot. And it makes a delicious gratin.
Yum.
Layer Swiss chard and cheese.
Why would I laugh at that, Chef?
Well, because you always go, what are you going to do, puree or gratin?
No, we always ask if you're going to add mustard or harissa. I think that's more.
If you do a Swiss chard gratin, the great thing is you have all those green leaves left. You can just quickly saute them in a pan with a little butter, maybe some toasted hazelnut, and a dash of little red wine vinegar right on top of that. And you put that as a garnish to your gratin. So now you have a yin and yang kind of going on the Swiss chard.
I like that. Tom, collards. This feels like a very Tom Douglas green, the collard green.
So is, and especially where I am right now. I'm eating all these smoky hams down here in Benton County, Tennessee.
So jealous. That sounds delicious.
Yeah, and collard greens or those kohlrabi tops or turnip greens or anything like that is very popular here. And I think should be popular in more places, especially collards. They have such a nice depth, earthiness.
Oh, yeah.
Just great velvety kind of flavor. And I say velvety flavor because I think a lot of times flavor in your mind comes off of your palate, not necessarily as in what we think of typically as flavor, but it's mm-hmm. texture. They get velvety when they're stewed in tomatoes. I always use a little bit of bacon grease, maybe some a garnish with some crispy bacon bits because if you don't have the grease, you have to cook the bacon, get the grease, and then you have to make your collards. It's just the law.
It's worth it.
The law.
And it's worth it.
I'll use a can of tomatoes or something like that, and then for my sweetness, I generally will put in a tablespoon or two of molasses and stew all of that together. And the greens get really, really velvety. And, of course, in the spring, you don't have to cook them very much at all. You can just julienne them and make a quick stir fry. But summertime hot greens, you need to stew and add a little sweetness to them or they do get bitter.
Yeah, and collard greens are great because they have a lot of give. You know, it's not like spinach that disappears in 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of give. Spinach, you got to be very attentive, mm-hmm. but collard green, you braise gently, put a cover on while you're cooking your steak or whatever, and, you know, the two meet at the end, and it's delicious.
So, to all of our listeners out there, if you're listening to this on St. Paddy's Day and you're still thinking about what it is that you can make that's very thematic to go along with your Guinness and Jameson shot, greens.
Or braise some cabbage in Guinness, too. That would be delicious.
Yeah, but you can move away from the cabbage if you want.
Exactly.
Or stick to the cabbage. Really up to you. It's your special holiday. All right. Coming up, our Taste of the Week from restaurants in Seattle and beyond. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show, a special edition because I'm calling in from the mountains of Tennessee, eastern Tennessee, from the famed Blackberry Farm. If you've never heard about it, you should go online and check it out. It's quite the place. I'm here just for about 12 hours so far, so I don't really know much about it. But I do know that I'm looking forward to having a tour of the archery fields this afternoon. I'm having dinner at what is considered one of the best restaurants in America tonight. I think it's called the Barn Restaurant here at the farm. It's 4,000 plus acres. There's lots of activities. I have my very own golf cart, you guys. That's so exciting.
Is there golfing involved?
No, there's no golfing, but
you just get to go to the cart.
Yeah. I'm going to drive into town, which is 10 miles away.
With a golf cart?
Walland, Tennessee. No.
Okay.
I'm going to drive into town and go junking because there's a bunch of antique stores there, and I'm a junker.
Mm.
I'm looking forward to spending the next couple of days here. It's a bucket list trip for my wife, Jackie, and I got it for her for our 34th wedding anniversary.
Well, congratulations.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, let's talk our tastes of the week. Tom, you've been traveling, so maybe it's something from where you are right now in Tennessee. Terry, I know you're fresh back from Vietnam.
So many tastes of the week.
And I know that Sarah, our production assistant, also has a taste of the week as well. So, Sarah, why don't you kick it off for us? Something local.
Sure. And I know, Katie, you have the same one. I went over to Salt and Straw. I went to the one in Capitol Hill that just opened up a couple of weeks ago.
How long did you wait in line?
It was a Friday night, so a pretty long time. It was worth it, though. I mean, it was nice once we got indoors.
Yeah, exactly.
So Salt and Straw, for a little bit of background, is a very popular ice creamery from Portland, Oregon. And they just recently opened up two shops in the Seattle area, one in Ballard and one in Capitol Hill. And they have just been jamming.
Well, they specialize in special flavors.
Correct. They specialize in specialty flavors. Sarah, what flavor did you get?
I had two flavors. I had Beecher's cheese, and I had a lemon and peppercorn flavor.
Wow, you went very interesting. How was that cheese-flavored ice cream?
It was really good. They were both really good. Mm-hmm. They managed to still be pretty sweet while, you know, displaying the flavor of both the cheese and the peppercorn in particular, and that lemon and peppercorn one was a nice little like flavor burst in every lick.
I went a little bit more traditional. I also went to Salt and Straw. I didn't have to wait in line. I just hit it at a perfect moment, I suppose.
Those 5 minutes of quietness.
Right, exactly. And they had a specialty flavor up, and it was the Franz Gold Bar. So a lot of people are familiar with Franz chocolate. They have an item called the Gold Bar that has nuts and caramel and chocolate in it. And it was, I got to say, pretty delicious. But the thing about Salt and Straw, and Sarah, maybe you would agree with this, is that what is so good about it is the texture of the ice cream. It's somewhere in between a stiffer ice cream, like you would think of like a Haagen-Dazs, and somewhere between that and like a soft serve. So it was a really good texture. The chocolate in my particular ice cream was very flaked, kind of like what we think of when we think of like a stracciatella chocolate in an Italian gelato. So really enjoyed that. Thierry, tell us about Vietnam and a taste that you had. I know it's hard to pick one.
Okay, I'll start from the banh mi. I had a revelation about banh mi. I mean, I've had for many years had the banh mi at Saigon Deli, you know, on Jackson. And that was always one of my favorite, you know, pretty much around town. The most common one I get. I had a banh mi revelation in Hanoi. That was pretty amazing. We went to this place. This guy that was with us took us to this place. He said, I think you're going to love this banh mi. This is my favorite. And again, he's Vietnamese. I'm like, okay, I'm going to trust him, obviously. It was a revelation. The banh mi was filled up with this pork belly that was cooked in a one-pot kind of dish.
Was it stewed?
Caramelized on the outside. Tender on the inside. No hardness to the bacon, to the belly. Oh my God! It was every mouthful, and then the secret of that banh mi also was the bread. The baguette was just like it came right out of the oven. It was tender on the inside. It was beautifully crisp on the and nicely toasted and crisp on the outside. It was the perfect baguette. I have never had a banh mi as good as this banh mi, and I looked for it again through Oyon and Saigon and. No such luck. That was definitely. I mean, in Saigon, they said, "Oh, that's the best banh mi." Not even close. It was not. I mean, it was different.
Oh, interesting.
But it was not the same as this one.
I think regionally, those things that that we're talking about in terms of Vietnam really change from south to north,
absolutely,
and to the coasts and whatnot. So the fillings end up changing. But what I would say, in regards to the banh mi topic of what you find in Vietnam is. Like a lot of good hamburgers, I would say, it's not really each individual component, but how it all works together and create a very specific, well-formed texture. And that was kind of the magic I felt about that particular banh mi style, is that bread really, really brings it together. Tom, we only have a couple minutes. Do you want to share your taste of the week?
You know, I guess I'll go with breakfast this morning that I had here because I haven't really been out much. I've been traveling to North Carolina to play golf, and then I also and had nothing really good back in North Carolina. I got to say, it was a little bit disappointing. And I've been on the search for barbecue on my 3.5-hour drive here from Nashville and had no luck with that. So I'm going to say the grits that I had this morning. And sometimes you go to a store and you think, am I going to buy like the Bob's Red Mill grits or am I going to? Sometimes you'll see the little bags of grits that are next to them, and they're like $10 or $12 for a one-pound bag of grits. And you're thinking, $2 for Bob's Red Mill or $10 or $12 for Southern Stone Ground grits. And I really think it's worth it. I really think that, you know, they go a long way. Like, they quadruple in size when you cook them. They go far if you add delicious ingredients to them. Like the ones this morning that I had were fluffy. They were cooked perfectly, fluffy with great butter. It was salt and pepper. And I had a little side of the little Benton ham here that is so popular, which is more of a Virginia-style ham, I would call it, kind of southern dried ham that's not necessarily smoked, although I think this had a touch of smoke on it. But I just love that salty, tough, heavy bite of that ham compared to the ones that are we're used to that are kind of pumped up with brines.
A lot of salt
and
water.
Don't have much chew to them, yeah. These have a lot of chew because they're dried in warehouses and lofts and things like that. So
well, Tom,
that was my favorite taste of the week.
Tom, I have to say, you just prepped us up for our next segment, which is questions from our listeners, and we've got one about grits, so I feel like you are right on the money. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. back to the Seattle Kitchen. It is KDO here with chefs Tom Douglas and Thierry Rotrow. Thierry Rotrow is still stuffing his face full of breakfast, Tom. You can't see it, but it's the truth of what's happening. As he
delicious, though, delicious.
Oh, good. You're all finished. We are heading into questions from our listeners, and boy, oh, boy, we have a ton of them. So let's jump right on in. This is from our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen. If you have a question for any of us, head over there, ask away, and we will do our best to answer your query. The first question comes from Jennifer Philbrook, and she would like to know, my family and I had brunch at the Carlisle Room a couple of weeks ago. Isn't that music to your ears, Tom?
Especially anyway, if it wasn't for free.
maybe it was one of those giveaways that we did of losing trivia. Mm-hmm. But she says that a couple weeks ago, she had some cheesy grits there that she cannot stop dreaming about. And Tom, grits have been on your mind. Can you give her any tips on how to make the perfect dreamy cheesy grits?
Let's see, I was just talking about the southern grit. So get a good grit to begin with.
Yeah, that's a big one.
And then they come in white or yellow. And typically I like the whites. I don't know why. And then slow cook them in water. I think sometimes we think that automatically you want to use chicken stock or something to give them more flavor. But no, you want to slow cook them in water, sometimes milk. You can cook them for a while in milk and they'll get nice and creamy. But cook them low and slow. And then at the last minute, right before you're ready to serve, then you want to, they should be tender, and then you want to stir in the cheese, stir in a fresh pat of butter, but like a cheese, like a, you know, like a Sonoma Jack or a Pepper Jack, something, a good melty type cheese, a good cheddar, and then just serve away. They will stiffen up as they cool, so you want to eat them while they're warm, and I just love them. Good salty piece of ham.
Yes, delicious. All right, the next question comes from Donna Hartman Miller, and she's a little bit of a food scientist here, and she says, odd question. I make steel-cut oatmeal often, and there is a goo, for lack of a better word, that forms on the top when you dish it up, and it's left behind. It reminds me a bit of what potato starch and cornstarch look like after it thickens up a bit. I am wondering, is there any reason I shouldn't use this as a thickener? And if your answer is, go ahead and try it, can you give me a couple options you would recommend trying first? Interesting. Tom, Thierry, have you ever used the residue from your steel-cut oatmeal to use it as a thickener?
No, I have not. But
Why wouldn't you stir it in when the oats are done?
Exactly. That's usually what I do, is you stir everything in and I don't take it on the side. But
if she wanted to, what do you think about? I mean, she's obviously not.
She's obviously a scientist, and she wants to play around.
Yeah, and so she wants to play around a little bit.
There's no doubt then that would be a good thickener for something. But I never did that. I like that to be back into my dish. I mean, it's part of my dish, so I didn't take it aside. So, but it's an interesting.
All right, idea. So if I understand the question right, she wants to skim off that. Mm-hmm. That kind of residue, save it and use it as a thickener. And so if I was to try it to see if it worked, I would say something like a gravy, you know, where you just have your chicken stock, instead of adding flour to make a roux, I would just do your gravy without the fat then, or maybe a fatless gravy, and then stir in that residue towards the end to see if it helps thicken it up rather than keeping to reduce it more. I don't think flavor-wise it's going to hurt it any, and I would it'd be fun to give it a try. I don't think, like in a gelatin or something like that, I don't think that would be attractive.
No.
Right. But using it in some thicker form, like a gravy, would be fun.
All right. The next question comes from Larissa Zubair, and she would like to know, bay leaves, better fresh or dried? I bought a bay leaf for my backyard. Should I dry the leaves or use them fresh?
Well, if you can use them fresh, they have a lot more potency. What do you call it? Potency?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You got
Thank
it.
You. A lot, you know, more strength. So it's also a little bit of a different flavor. You get, you know, that green fresh bay leaf flavor is definitely stronger. But it's the easiest thing in the world to dry. You know, you put them away in your kitchen for a day or two and let them dry out a little bit, and then put them in a container, and you've got beautiful dry bay leaf. And it's definitely better to have the one from your backyard, because you know when you get them and you know how long it's been. Sometimes the one you buy in the store, if you don't go to a spice place, they could be 2 years old and they have a lot less potency.
Yeah, so pretty flavorless.
I have seen bay leaf that you needed five bay leaf to make flavor away. If you take a fresh bay leaf one will make a lot of flavor.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. All right. The next question comes from Alonzo Brizuela, and they would like to know, I've been trying to cut out gluten from my diet and have been eating a lot more vegetables and small amounts of animal protein. Any suggestions besides salads and steamed veggies? Oh, Alonzo, yes. I mean,
so much.
So many things other than steamed vegetables, although delicious, and they have their place.
Coming right back from Vietnam, I'd say use rice flour.
You use rice flour. That is a great alternative if you're avoiding gluten.
Make beautiful noodles.
Let's talk about maybe that for a hot second. So bún chả is something that you see both here in Seattle, because we have a big Vietnamese population, but something that you obviously saw on your travels.
Mm-hmm.
Can you walk Alonzo through kind of what that looks like, obviously taking into consideration that he can replace the animal protein with a tofu?
Yeah.
But what does that dish commonly look like, Thierry?
It's basically normally ground chicken or ground pork or ground beef. I've seen it like many different types. And a little bit of hot chili. It's basically the whole thing is ground and rolled into a pasta. I would call it pasta, or like a noodle rice.
A rice wrapper.
Rice wrapper, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's very simple. It's very basic. You know,
they make a little egg roll. That's thing number one.
Yeah.
But then it's also on a bed of nice like chilled rice noodles, generally.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And those rice noodles are actually, that's the secret of that dish, because you can have a clump of rice noodle or you can have some beautiful light rice noodle.
Mm-hmm.
And those make a big difference, I
mm-hmm.
think.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, the dish, you know, fish sauce and is one of the most beautiful discovery of Vietnam. I mean, fish sauce with many different things. And then you can also use a little sweet and sour, which is also another great thing I saw throughout Vietnam that's so delicious. They have a great way to do it. So it's, you know, you dump, little dipping is very much necessary for that dish.
But Alonzo, the nice thing about that dish too, you should know, is that you can employ a lot of different little crunchy vegetables in there, whether
mm-hmm.
they're fresh and julienned or
kohlrabi,
or pickled
kohlrabi. Carrots.
Yeah, we can get that kohlrabi back in there. And a lot of herbs. I think the way that you make vegetarian cooking and cutting out a lot of protein and still keeping things flavorful is fresh herbs, you know,
cilantro,
spices, cilantro, all that sort of stuff. Tom, do you have any thoughts on great ways to go a little bit gluten-free, use less animal proteins, and do something different than just salads and steamed veggies?
Well, I'm a big fan of those large, wide rice noodles and stir-fried with things like using eggs rather than meats, I think are fine. Katie, your thought on the fresh herbs, I mean, that to me is the big contribution to the culinary world in the last 25 years is the Vietnamese use of soft herbs, so whether it's Thai basil, cilantro, chives, you know, the French tarragon,
shiso,
you name it,
add
mint,
in there, yeah.
Shiso, yeah. Those kind of things added to your salads and to your entrees really have changed the flavor palette for me over the last 25
years.
Me too. I think are very important to modern cooking.
Well, that is all the time we have for questions from you, our dear, dear listeners. Keep sending them in, and we will try to answer them on our next show. Coming up, we host a dinner party using Guinness in every course. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen. I am Katie O, and it is time
for a private dinner in your house.
That's right. In my little tiny apartment, we are going to have a dinner party. And because it is St. Paddy's Day weekend, we will be using Guinness in every course. I'm here with chefs Tom Douglas and Thierry Rotero, my professional personal caterers. Yeah. I'm one of the few lucky people that can say that every week, nearly. And as we do with our dinner party, we're going to invite a special guest. And because it's St. Paddy's Day, and because we're using Guinness, the most famous Irish person I know, Liam Neeson.
Yes. Taken 1, Taken two, taken three. He's going to be taken four if he comes with us.
That's right. The A-Team, Star Wars, Schindler's List. He's been in it all. He's really got some range, that Liam Neeson. And as I mentioned, as we do, we are going to use Guinness in every single course. The first one feels pretty darn easy, which is the cocktail appetizer portion of this. Who would like to go first?
Well, you know what they say about Guinness. Don't mess with the Guinness.
Don't mess with the Guinness, people. Like to mess with the Guinness. Tom, did you want to go first?
Sure. I'm going to have the Guinness. You know, I'm not much of a beer drinker. And I will say I'm glad I'm having this at your house because I had a dinner party at my house last week. And when we went out to wish everyone goodbye, one of my guests' cars was stolen out of my driveway.
What? So,
I guess I don't live in a very safe neighborhood.
Apparently not. You don't really hear of full carjacking, but wow.
That is scary.
Well, yeah, stolen right out of my driveway. So I feel like if at your house with Liam Neeson, that's just not going to happen. I mean, taken is one thing, but...
They're stealing the wrong car, the wrong guy.
Yeah, I will hunt you down if you're the last thing I do on Earth. For my car stealers, I just make them dinner, apparently. So
that's very nice.
So we're just going to go with the cold Guinness, but I'm going to take the barley that they use to make Guinness. You know, one of the ways they get the color of Guinness is they roast that barley to a certain caramelization. Mm. And I love it as a snack food. And I'll take that same barley, that kind of dark toasted barley, and I'll put it into, I'll take some sugar, put it into a pan on high heat. And just as it caramelizes, just as the sugar starts to go golden brown, I'll pull it off. And then I'll throw my barley in there. And actually, I'm going to change the way I do this for the home cook because mine's a little bit different. I'm going to put my barley into the hot pan, get it super hot, and then I'm going to sprinkle sugar over top, and it'll caramelize to the barley. And then that's going to go into my homemade Chex Mix because, you know, Chex Mix and Guinness are a classic combination.
Delightful.
That is the kind of stuff that we do.
Barley Chex Mix with the Guinness, and I think people are going to be super happy.
I'd be super happy with that.
That's funny. I would never even come close to think about this. Mm. Oh, that's funny.
Well, Terry, now it's your turn up to bat. So Tom has kicked it off with a little snack and a bev.
Liam Neeson is...
Liam.
I was going to call him Yam. Liam Neeson is a very tough guy, so I think we're going to start right off the bat with a smoked duck breast. Little appetizer with a... I'm going to make a sampa salad. Sampa being the barley, you know, fermented and lightly smoked. I'm going to do a salad of that with some golden raisin, some pink peppercorn. I'm going to crack and toast some pink peppercorn, but not crack, chopped and really ground some pink peppercorn and lightly toasted and put that into that salad with a mustard dressing and some watercress on the side. And I love watercress this time. I had some watercress yesterday, and I was like, you know, we don't use watercress anymore. It used to be such a hot thing, but we don't use it anymore, which is a shame. It's a beautiful vegetable. It's a beautiful green.
Things come in and out of fashion.
They do, and it's too bad because watercress is actually delicious, especially now, beginning of spring.
And
like
they
that.
Look like little shamrocks. Perfect
exactly.
for our guest, Liam.
And if you're lucky to find a watercress that has four leaves.
Then you're super lucky. All right, Tom, are you ready for the main course?
Well, it's St. Patrick's Day, right? You have to have corned beef.
Yes.
I've actually been to Cornwall, England, just so you know. So I have some.
Is that really where it comes from?
I don't have a clue.
Either way.
It sounded good, though.
Yeah, you're very legit in my eyes. You actually helped me do my first corned beef last year, Tom. So I bet there are a lot of... Yes, you don't remember this? I needed a lot of help. I needed a lot of hand-holding, if I recall correctly. But take the listeners through your wonderful recipe.
Well, I'm just going to, since Liam's there, and since Guinness is our beverage of choice for the evening, I'm going to braise my corned beef in a half Guinness, half water bath.
Mm.
And if you get, you know, my favorite place to buy corned beef is Market House Corned Beef over at Olive M. Howell, I want to say.
It's been
Howell
there forever by the Metropolitan Towers.
Yes, exactly. And so I get a nice big brisket. Leave the fat on. It's going to simmer away. You can either simmer it in that in like a covered pot, or you can bake it in the oven as a, with a piece of foil over the top of the baking thing for the first couple of hours. Mm-hmm. Most people, when they have an issue with corned beef or brisket, they just don't cook it enough.
Right.
And then when they cut it, they tend to cut it with the grain instead of across the grain.
Which make it, everything so it makes it tougher. Up,
yeah, it comes out really stringy. Mm-hmm. But you want to leave all the fat in. You can trim the fat that you don't want. You can trim that after it's all cooked. That's the better time to trim.
Mm-hmm.
And for the last hour, you know, my mom always made boiled New England dinner is what she called it. And for the last hour, I'll take my potatoes, my carrots, wedges of cabbage that still have the core on so it doesn't fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll pop those right into that broth.
Yeah.
And I'll cook those for the last hour, too. And then, and now you have what is considered a classic boiled dinner. And then when it, you pull it all out, you do have to pull it out of the broth because corned beef is super salty. And when you cook it, your broth is going to get salty.
Mm-hmm.
You pull it all out, and then I put pats of butter. Or I'll even, you could even, if you're, since we're using Guinness, put some Guinness in a pan and stir a nice amount of butter into it and then just pour that over top as a broth over your boiled dinner.
Mm.
It would be so good, so delicious. And then a classic Irish soda bread on the side to kind of soak up all that dripping.
Oof,
so that's
sounds
what I'd be
delicious.
Having for, with Liam Neeson
Liam
at
Neeson
my
is...
side.
He's
guarding the vehicles in the driveway.
And you know, he's a pretty tough guy, so I think instead of dessert, we're going to do some Stilton with Guinness.
Mm.
A nice, beautiful, creamy blue, and some beautiful toasted baguette, and maybe some dried figs. Diced up, mix with a little bit of honey, mm-hmm. and put that as a garnish next to the Stilton, and then serve a beautiful Guinness. But Guinness, you know, you got to have the glass in the freezer. You got to make sure that Guinness is super, super cold and get that beautiful creaminess right on top.
Delicious.
You know, I'm not a beer drinker or that much of a beer drinker, but I tell you, a Guinness is a serious issue. Because you drink one and you're like, man, I could have another. It feels like you're drinking hot chocolate when you drink, well, or cold chocolate.
I was going to say hot chocolate.
But it's so beautiful and creamy. Mm.
Now, have either of you, Tom, I feel like you've probably been to Ireland, Tira. I'm not sure that
no,
you have.
I
have not myself, but I've heard time and time again that the Guinness is much more delicious on draft.
Correct.
In Ireland. Can anyone corroborate this?
Hmm. Well, I've heard of it, too.
You know, I've been to Ireland several times. Scotland, they don't really drink Guinness as much in Scotland. You know, I don't know. I think some of that stuff is wives' tales. They make a Guinness that has a nitrogen. They call it a nitrogen
mm-hmm.
pack,
mm-hmm.
which is supposed to make it taste more like a natural draft Guinness.
Mm-hmm.
So I would look for that as a much cheaper alternative than flying to Ireland for a Guinness.
Significantly.
Flying to Ireland for a beer. Yeah, that's
yeah, nice. Exactly.
You know, Guinness is
and
great.
Has,
sorry, Tom, go ahead.
Has Liam Neeson ever been a romantic interest in a movie, or is he just always like the crazy
gun
toter?
I think he was in Love Actually, wasn't he? Did I make that up? That's a very romantic film. I can look on IMDb as we speak right now. But he's a really romantic person in
he loves his
real
wife
life.
And his daughter.
His wife passed away.
I know,
I
guess why
that.
I ask because I'm so curious of who he's bringing the dinner with. He's not coming solo.
No.
And it might be the better guest is who he's bringing to dinner.
I think we'll have to ask him before he comes over who his plus one is.
His wife died in a car accident, so I don't know. I mean, in a skiing accident. I don't know who he's with now, and I'm so curious.
I guess we're all hitting TMZ and typing Liam Neeson's name into the search query.
We'll send him the invite and see who responds.
All right. Well, that was a very, very delicious St. Patty's Day themed dinner party at my place. Thanks for cooking, guys. I'll do the dishes. Up next, we've got Food for Thought, our tasty trivia challenge. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen. It is time for our favorite segment, Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. I'm Katie O, here with Thierry Rotero and Tom Douglas, who is away in Tennessee right now. And because we do not have a special guest in our studio, Tina Knoll, our producer, will be administering the quiz. Take it over,
Tina.
Are
you trying to say I'm not special, Katie? That hurt.
No, you're special. You're always special. You're just a very regular guest on the show.
Alrighty. Well, here's how the game is played. Each of you will get five questions. Whoever gets the most correct is the winner. Whoever gets the least out of five correct is the loser. All right. So each of you will need to pony something up for a listener that you will be playing for. Today we're playing for Alonzo Bruzella.
Bruzella.
Thank you, Terry. Who on our Facebook page asked a really important question that you guys answered earlier in the show about gluten-free vegetable dishes. And you guys had terrific answers for that. So, Katie, if you should lose this quiz, what will you give away to Alonzo?
Alonzo, I would like you to go to the Palace Kitchen because I was there this past weekend. The menu looked delicious up and down. I think you're going to find a lot of great gluten-free veggie-friendly options on there. So how about a little, like, little snacky-poo there? Gift card for $75. You and a friend. Go have a cocktail. Have some nibbles.
Awesome. I'm gonna say that you can come to Luke and have a brunch on Saturday or Sunday and definitely find some gluten-free items. We have tons of egg dishes that have no gluten in it. So
nice. Is Alonzo allowed to bring somebody along?
Of course. Of course.
You and the guests. Two for brunch at Luke. Wonderful. Hey, Tom, out there in Tennessee, if you, on rare occasion, should lose this quiz, what will you be giving away to Alonzo?
You know, I kind of wish it was more rare than it actually is.
Well, you
I'm
always
starting to lose confidence.
You know, you go pretty high at the beginning of the show saying how you're going to beat us up, so
I know.
You set yourself
up. I'm struggling. Anyway, I am going to give Alonzo a dinner for two at the Carlisle Room, where we have lots and lots of vegetables. As a matter of fact, we have one dish that has five of our vegetable plates on it called the giant rainbow plate. So I think that would be my choice for Alonzo.
Sounds delicious.
All right. Who would like to go first today?
I'll start.
Chef Terry, what does one associate the term noble rot with?
Oh, it's with grapes that are rotted to make beautiful Sauternes or late harvest wine.
Perfect. Absolutely. That was a beautiful answer, Terry.
Oh, thank you.
Terry, question number two. If you were served pesca martello, what would you be eating? Octopus, shark, or squid?
That would probably be a shark because martello means hammer.
Beautiful.
And the only thing I can associate it with that is a shark.
Nicely done. What Arab country's national dish is a soup called fool?
I have no idea. I wish I knew, but I'd never heard that name before. So I know what a fool is, but who would be fool enough to name a soup a fool? I'm going to go with Ireland.
You know, a lot of people don't know that Ireland is an Arab country. That's
the interesting part about all of this. That's the real trivia that everyone's going to take away.
Little known fact.
So what country was it?
Egypt, actually.
All right. I was a little bit far away.
Chef,
just south of Ireland.
Chef, what are the main ingredients of vichyssoise soup?
Leeks and potatoes.
Correct. Job.
Big classic, and this time of year, perfect dish.
All right, your last question. You now have three out of five questions correct. Cullen skink is hearty soup made with potatoes, onion, and which fish? You have some options here. Smoked haddock, smoked tuna, or salmon?
I'm going to go with smoked haddock.
Beautiful. Terry, that's four out of five.
Wow.
Valiant showing today.
Really
nice.
Strong.
Boy,
back from vacation.
Yeah, fresh.
Raring to go.
Fresh
coming
meat.
In hot. Miss Katie, would you like to go next?
I sure would.
All right, here we go. The name for which Mexican dish stems from the word for mule?
Moscow mule?
The name for which Mexican dish stems from the word mule? I'm afraid to give you options because I know you'll get
mole?
It.
Mole?
No,
no.
I'll give you your options because
It
is multiple choice.
Yeah, let's not ring that buzzer too quick.
Sean
Del Torre.
Good judging.
I mean,
taco burrito or tostada?
Taco Oh, burrito. Got it. Taco. Let me think. Taco. I do like tacos.
What name is given to the small snacks traditionally served with drinks in Spain?
Tapas?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Tapas. What word beginning with the letter P is a salted snack popular in the U.S. and Germany?
Pretzels? I almost said peanuts for a hot second. I was like, peanuts? No, that doesn't seem German at all.
Katie, what drink was the first American consumer product sold legally in Russia? Was that Coke, Sprite, or Pepsi?
I bet it was something weird like Pepsi.
Correct. Well, Katie, 4 out of 4 today. Coming in hot. What is the most consumed meat in China? And there's no options here.
Jeez,
just got to get this
one.
I get it.
I'm going to say, in my mind, it seems like chicken, but is it going to be something weird like goat? I'm going to go chicken.
The answer we're looking for is pork.
Oh.
All right. Katie and Terry have tied with 4 out of 5. Tom Douglas, you need 5 out of 5 correct to win this quiz today. Are you ready for it?
Okay, I'm going to do it.
Okay.
Yeah. That's very confident. I like that.
What is the name of the Turkish dish of vine leaves filled with rice, onions, and chopped meat? Is that pilaf, dolmas, or baklava?
Dolmas.
Correct. Tom, which fruit is used to make a traditional Black Forest gâteau? Is that cherries, strawberries, or apples?
Cherries.
Correct. Which country consistently produces the most ice wine each year? Is that France, Canada, or the United States?
Canada.
Yes.
Wow. 3 out of 3. 2 more for the win. Mm-hmm. What name do Australians give to a pastry made with almonds, sugar, and cream? Oh. Anzac biscuits, fairy bread, or frangipani?
Frangipani.
Correct. Oddly enough, I mispronounced that today at the Grand Central Bakery when ordering it. Just learned that one. That's 4 out of 4. You must get this one correct in order to win. What do Limeswood Gorgonzola and Stilton cheese have in common?
They're all blues.
That's right.
That is 5 out of 5.
And they're
for
not
Tom
from
Douglas.
Tennessee. Wow.
Katie and Terry, because you are tied, we're going to give you one question. It is a fight to the finish here.
Okay.
One of you must get this one correct to win. All right. Your question is this. The Cajun Holy Trinity of cooking consists of what 3 vegetables? Katie.
Onion.
Yes.
Green bell pepper.
Yes.
Carrot.
Tina.
Oh, I'm so sorry,
so
Katie.
Close.
You are so close. The answer is celery. Celery. Alonzo will be enjoying a wonderful happy hour at the Palace Kitchen, courtesy of Katie.
Yeah. You're welcome. This show was produced by Tina Knoll at Large Media. Our associate producer is Sarah Leibovitz. If you'd like to be part of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets. They're only $15 and you get coffee and a breakfast sandwich and our sparkling conversation. Also, remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our Apple Podcast or download the Cairo Radio app. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Have a nice weekend.